Have you seen the hands of all the visitors? Are there any alcoholics in the room? It's interesting. You don't look like alcoholics. In fact, whether they're alcoholics, they're often Al-Anons. Do we have any Al-Anons in the audience? That's enough. Don't overdo it. We have to go back to living with them when we need to, you know. We alcoholics have a disease that is not only untreatable, but it's incurable. Manifested by an allergy of the body and a compulsion of the mind, and it's called alcoholism. But the Al-Anons have a disease that's so weird you haven't even thought of a name for it yet. This is a convention. I don't know about newcomers. In fact, I don't care whether you call yourself a newcomer or what you call yourself. If you're 30 days or less of sobriety on the program, would you raise your hand? 30 days or less of sobriety. Here? Is that great? That's good. I've got the rest of the program, more or less, to explain this whole program to you now. But after about 5 or 10 minutes, I get to be kind of a bore. So I'll give you the short version. You know. If you attach to the short version, then you can use the rest of the time to turn your mind off and meditate or something. But if you can, newcomers will read the book, work the steps, and go to meetings, 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 and not drink between meetings, everything will get better. It just has to get better. I'm glad to be here tonight. Every speaker says that. But really, I'm glad to be who I am and where I am and doing what I'm doing and heading wherever I seem to be heading. And it's been that way for the last several days for me. And I like it that way. Because it hasn't always been that way. Max and I have been married 32 years now, and we went through the various stages of living together as I drank, with her starting off saying, "You don't like me. You don't like me. Why don't you admit it? You love me, but you don't like me." And then she went into the next stage where she was yelling, "You don't love me. You don't love me. Why don't you admit it?" And we reached the third stage where she was screaming at me, "You hate me, you hate me, why don't you admit it, you hate me?" So I admitted it. I remember the way I admitted it to her. In fact, I think it was rather profound at the time. It was one of the few profound things I've ever said. I remember telling her, I remember saying, "Woman, there's only one world, only one person in the world whose guts I hate worse than yours, and that's my own." And that's the way I felt. And neither one of us knew what to do about it. And I didn't like who I was, or what I was, and I didn't like where I was, and I didn't like what I was doing, and I didn't like where I was heading. But neither one of us knew what to do about it. And so I cried a little and went and mixed me another drink. And didn't know what else to do. We had a difficult time through our marriage. If you had a wife like mine, you'd drink too. You know? If you had my responsibilities, you'd drink too. She was a lot of trouble to me, really. A lot of trouble. I worked hard trying to straighten her out. Sent her to 3 different psychiatrists. At different times. Sent the kids to psychiatrists. Sent her to hypnotists. I took 6 courses in hypnosis myself so I could hypnotize her. I read her positive thinking books. Sent her to the Charles Simmons course. It's pitiful what I had to put up with that woman, you know? And the harder I worked on her, the sicker she got. she, you know, she kept getting sicker. It really didn't surprise me when it ended up at the psycho ward. But it really amazed me when that steel door slammed shut and she's the one that went home. Our marriage was a mistake. And I thought everything that happened to me that I hadn't planned that way was a mistake. I thought that adopting our two kids was a terrible mistake and a dirty trick to play on them. And today I know that nothing happens to me by mistake. It's the way it's supposed to be. But at that time, everything seemed that wasn't right or wasn't the way I planned it seemed to be a mistake. I even came to AA by mistake. In fact, I didn't come here, I was sent. I was sent here by this narrow-minded psychiatrist who couldn't see that my problems were marital. You know. I knew I didn't belong here because I wasn't an alcoholic. I was a pillar of the community, and whoever saw a community with a drunken pillar? I thought an alcoholic was somebody that was insensitive to what he was doing and to the things he was doing to other people. And he liked to drink in spite of all the things that were going on. And I wasn't like that. I was very sensitive. And I knew what I was doing. And I knew what was happening. And each day I'd go through the day, and then I would sit home at night that night and drink and think about what had gone wrong and what I was going to do the next day to straighten things out. And drinking was the solution to the problem. I used to sit and drink while trying to figure out why I drank, you know. I was started out life kind of young and as a in a drugstore. It was in a drugstore and a house combination, and the house and the drugstore, the house was above and behind. You couldn't tell where one stopped and the other started, and the family fights went right through the whole thing. And, I didn't like being a drugstore boy. And the house, the family, it was all right. I just didn't feel at home there. And I kept wondering when they were going to tell me I was adopted. But I thought being raised in a drugstore was a real dumb thing to do, and I was never going to do that. In fact, I remember one time I was talking to my dog. I always talk to my dog. I now have three dogs. I talk to them and two cats, too. But this dog's name was Timmy. And I was talking to Timmy, and he and I were on the floor, and I asked him. I said, do you feel lonely and depressed like I do? You know, that dumb dog got up and slowly walked away. And I figured, until I got the AA, I figured that's what people will do. You never really tell people what you really feel, or that's what they'll do, just slowly walk away. They don't want to hear that. And it seems to me about that same time, there was a story going around about, not a story going around, it was in the family, that the story that my mother had come home from the neighbors and had gotten some bad booze or something, or somebody spiked a drink or something, and apparently she acted intoxicated, and this upset my old aunt, who thought I was going to ruin this drugstore business and raised a lot of devil with her. And anyway, I didn't see the incident or anything, but anyway, she's supposed to have talked to the Blessed Virgin Mother about this and told her that if she would get her out of this trouble, she'd never ever drink again. She took a vow to never drink. And as far as I know, she never did. She prayed a lot, and she died sober. Never saw my mother take a drink. Which proved to me that if you did have a drinking problem, the answer to it is to find the right saint, or say the right litany, or the right novena, or the right number of rosaries, or go to mass often enough, pray hard enough to the right saint, you know, that'd take care of it. God, I was a praying drunk, you know. I never found the right saint. Even St. Jude, patron of hopeless cases. I get through the novena and the message come back, yeah, your case is hopeless, you know. Never worked. My very own mother could do it, but I couldn't. I started drinking to get to sleep at night. I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a sleeping problem. And I remember back in pharmacy school, I would go to school all day and come home and work in the drugstore. And then I'd study like mad until 12, 1, 2 o'clock and jump in bed and try to sleep. And everything I had thought, I'd be half asleep and half awake, and everything I'd studied would get all mixed up in my mind, and I'd get up in the morning tired and stupid. Or else I could drink a beer, and I could jump in bed and sleep real fast and wake up real smart and refreshed, you know. And so I chose to be smart. And so I would drink a beer when I got through studying before I went to bed. I had a terror of lying there awake, not being able to fall asleep as soon as I got to bed. And of course, as time went on, it took more and more to get me to sleep. But I thought it was because my responsibilities increased. I thought, I went to pharmacy school, then I went on to graduate school, then I went to medical school, and then I went into specialty training, and then I went into practice, and everything was getting worse and worse and bigger and a bigger load to carry, and I thought that's why I needed to drink more or less. I guess that's what I thought anyway, because I drank more. As a matter of fact, I found that it wasn't keeping me asleep. What would happen, I'd wake up, and then I'd have to drink myself back to sleep. And I would drink myself back to sleep as often as 3 times a night. But even when when I was practicing medicine and drinking myself back to sleep, I would have no respect for a doctor who drank on the job, so I wouldn't drink in the morning. I had a 5 o'clock shut-off date. 5 a.m. If it was 5 a.m., I just stayed up and acted like a martyr. And it was 3 minutes till 5, I drank myself back to sleep. As I said, I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a sleeping problem. And I'd like to tell you how I don't need to do that anymore, and I sleep well. It's really very simple. It has been very simple for me. When I became willing to go to any length, to not take anything to help me sleep, and turned it over in the third step, and let it be God's problem whether I drank or slept or not. When it was His problem, and I didn't have to worry about it, then I'm able to sleep when I do that. I decided if I was going to die from lack of sleep, it would be His fault. And I just let Him worry about it. And as long as I can do that, I don't have any trouble sleeping. I remember when I was, one of the things I had to do was to get out of the habit of watching the clock. And so I didn't watch the time of when I wake up and when I fall asleep. I remember I awakened one night during the night and I started to take my arm down from under the pillow to look at my watch, and I stopped because I wasn't watching the time anymore. And in the morning I was wondering why I'd even wanted to look at my watch. I obviously didn't have any appointments with anybody. I wasn't going anywhere. And the only reason I could think of as to why I want to know what time it was is so I know how tired to be the next day. I don't have to do that anymore. But as a result of the drinking at night mostly, the nights were when I had an awful lot of trouble. I remember so many nights that I would wake up. I don't know if you'd call it wake up, but I'd become conscious of the fact that it was the middle of the night. I'd gotten out of bed and I'd crossed the bedroom and I had turned on the light and I was now hanging up the phone, having just terminated the conversation with somebody who had called me. And I wouldn't know who I'd talked to. And I wouldn't know whether I'd said, well, rush to the hospital and I'll meet you there, or jump back in bed and I'll run out and make a house call, or take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. And it was very confusing. That happened so many times that finally what I did is I didn't decide to cut down on my drinking. I decided that what I would do is I'd get a pad and pencil by every phone. And I had 2 phone lines and 3 extensions at each one, and a pad and pencil at each one, and I told the kids and my wife, absolutely don't touch that pad and pencil. Never use that pencil. Alice is very important. Your father's a doctor. I almost said your father's a drunk. And Ed, I had them all trained. Don't touch that pad or pencil. And I trained myself to never answer the phone without a pad and a pencil in my hand and write down what was going on. And it worked, you know. It doesn't seem like it worked more than a few weeks. It may have been longer than that. But then I would get up in the morning, I'd find those notes, and I couldn't read them. So it didn't really solve it very long. It was about that time that I was having an increasing amount of trouble writing legibly anyway. The things at night of coming out of some state of unconsciousness and finding out it was pitch black and I was in a horizontal position and paralyzed from the armpits down and on a carpeted surface. And the only thing I knew was I had an awful full bladder. And at first I would mumble something about where am I or something, and this loud voice would boom out from above. You fell out of bed again. And my reaction was, you know, it's pitiful that I had to be married to such an ignorant woman. But I would think, how in God's name could I fall out of bed when I'm paralyzed? She never seemed to understand. And you know, to this day, I don't remember ever falling out of bed. I spent a lot of time on the floor, but I never... And needing to get to the bathroom, not knowing where it was, and too proud to ask. Especially not to ask her, for God's sake. I remember the first Christmas after I came on the program. I came on around Christmas time. And the first Christmas after, I hadn't said a word all that year. I was hiding in the corner so nobody would see me. And it was a Christmas afternoon meeting, and it was mixtures of AA and Elmont, and the topic was gratitude. We went around the room and asked to say what we had to be grateful for. And I was the last one to participate. And I remember saying that I thought that I was the most grateful person in the room. And the reason was that I had been up all night. That I had been, that in the late, about midnight of the night before, a patient had called. It sounded like he had a heart attack. I had him go to the emergency room, and he was having a heart attack, and I admitted him to the intensive care unit. And up there, he went into shock, and I had to treat him for that, and not over-treat him, and see his response, and then decide what to do next. At which point, he developed an arrhythmia, and I had to treat that, and I treated that, and then watched his response, and then he went into congestive failure. I had to treat that, and all night long, he was doing things that required something to be done, and I was doing them, and they're functioning. The fact that he lives is not the point of my story. It might be if he were telling the story. It's my story, and he stuck with it. The point was that I was glad to be able to be there and function, because a year before I came to AA, I had a similar situation. It was on New Year's Eve that night, that year, and man had had a heart attack, and I admitted him not to intensive care, but to the medical, regular medical ward, and I didn't think he was really very sick. And I remember I thought his wife seemed a little excitable about it, and I was very casual, and I don't know, went home and had a little bit of vodka, because I wasn't drinking, because I was on call, so I had vodka and orange juice, and that doesn't count. But about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I remember then hanging up the phone. Only then I knew who I was talking to. I saw him to the hospital, and I had told him I'd be right over, because they said that the man's heart had stopped, and this Dr. Ward was working on him, and they needed me badly. And I said I'd be right there. And with that, I hung up the phone and started back to the bed and fell on the floor. And had a terrible time trying to get my pajama bottoms off so I could get dressed. And while I'm doing this, rolling on the floor, my idiot wife is screaming at me that you can't go to the hospital in that condition. And I'm screaming back at her that she doesn't understand how important it is that I get there. And we screamed back and forth for a while until finally, I don't know what I did, but I couldn't get off the floor, so she called the hospital and said I wouldn't be there. And the reason that I was concerned, it was Dr. Ward, of all people, was that he, first off, he was the chief of staff at the hospital. And that shook my security a little bit. And also, he's the doctor that about 8 months or a year before that had called me one morning. And I stupidly took the call right in front of a patient I was talking to without having going to another room. I took the call, and he said that he had to get up the night before and go over to the hospital at 5 o'clock and declare dead a patient that I had declared dead at 3 o'clock. And the reason he had to do that was because the daughter of the deceased wouldn't allow her mother's body to be moved until another doctor had declared her dead, because when I was over, I was drunk. And I couldn't remember whether I was drunk or not. I didn't remember being drunk. I remembered being there, but I found it hard to think of something to say. I wasn't feeling very well that morning anyhow. And I remember saying something about, well, I had a bit of a cold and I take some antihistamines, and they sometimes make me act a little funny, and maybe that's what made her think I was acting funny. And he said, no. He said, she said that you look drunk and you walk drunk and you talk drunk and you smell drunk. You know, you know, it just kind of screwed up my whole day. I remember that evening, two friends of ours, about the only two that were left, came by the house to defend us, or to defend me, and tell me how they'd heard this rumor and they knew it wasn't true. And I didn't remember enough to be able to tell them what I did or didn't, whether or not it was true or what was going on. And I remember when they left, and all I could do was just sit there and not say anything. And when they left, the only solution, I really obviously couldn't sleep that night, so the answer was to drink. And I drank. I felt so bad about that whole incident that I had to sit there and drink myself to sleep. It was the only answer I knew. So when I saw that I was drinking too much and getting in trouble, I went through a long phase of trying to quit drinking. It seemed to me that I had a phase of drinking where I drank to get to sleep and it worked. And then I drank and it was getting me in trouble, so I tried to quit. And then I crossed an invisible line another time where I went into the phase where I no longer realized I was drinking, or that drinking was a problem, or that that had anything to do with all these tremendous number of problems I had. And then that phase ended when I got to AA. And now I'm in the fourth phase where I don't drink. But I did go through this phase where I tried to quit. I remember doing a lot of things. We had a bar, you know, it opened up. I had a bar. If it doesn't have alcohol, you have a bar. I drank at home, but our bar had folding doors on it. And you pull these two handles shut, and the four doors come shut. And I went down and bought a latch, and a lock, and a key. And I locked me out of my bar, you know. No, I was sincere about this. I went and gathered up all the booze that I had hidden around the house, all that I could remember, and put it in the bar, and I locked it. Locked the bar, and I did the obvious thing with a key. I gave it to my wife so we could fight over it every night. And so we did. Every night we had a fight, and eventually she'd give me the one drink so we could go to bed. I go make the scotch and soda, and
I'd have to mix hers with 1 little ounce of scotch and a tall glass of soda, 12 ounce glass, and look, you know, insipid. And look, and then I would mix mine with ice cubes and soda, and they didn't come out the same color. And I was always trying to get her to drink just a little bit more. And I'd bring just a little bit more than a 1 ounce. And no matter how little that little bit was, she'd always say, "Ooh, you make strong drinks." And I'd have to say, "Well, I'll drink it, you know. And it tastes just awful with all that soda. I didn't like scotch and I hated soda. And so I'd have to drink a little and add some scotch, you know, and then drink a little and add scotch. And by the time I got down to half a glass, it tasted pretty good. But I then, and she would have had her 1 ounce of scotch and gotten sleepy and gone off to bed. And then, she locked the damn bar before she did. And then my problem was to try to remember when she got the key, did I hear her slide open the door or a drawer or what? Because I knew I was going to have to go find that key. And every time I found it, she found a more tricky place to hide it the next time. So finally, I couldn't find the key. And then I'd go and get a bobby pin. And I'd lie on the floor and try to pick that lock, you know. I've seen movies where they pick the lock in prison, you know, and walk right out. I don't know where they get the bobby pins in prison, but I lay on the floor trying to pick this lock. I bought it at the 10-cent store, but I never managed to unlock that lock. And what I finally did is think, whose goddamn bar is this anyway? And I ripped the lock off, you know. Then you can buy plastic wood, fill up the holes. But you can only do that so many times, and then the screws won't even hold anything. So I decided to really go all the way with this not drinking. I was going to go to the extreme, and my friends would just no longer be able to have a drink in my home. I was just not going to have any booze in the house. We wouldn't lock the bar, there just wouldn't be any booze there, and anybody that came wanted to drink, they'd just have to do without. I was sorry for them, but that's the way it was going to have to be. And so I very sincerely went about drinking up the booze that was there. You know, I remember one time we were going to a dinner dance thing, and I was very worried all my life that people would think I drank too much. I don't know why I didn't drink too much, but I always thought they might think so. And I had to keep up my image as the outstanding physician there in the community. And, of course, the worst thing of all would be to go and not drink anything. And then they'd really think you were peculiar. So I had to drink a couple or three drinks, but I had to be real careful not to drink too much. This was way back in the beginning. And I remember we were going to this thing, and so Max drank scotch and soda, and I hated scotch, and I couldn't stand soda. So I decided, all I'll drink is scotch and soda, and I'll be able to control it in front of these people. I didn't have a drinking problem, but I thought they had funny attitudes. And I did it. We went there, and I spent the whole evening and ate the dinner and danced a few dances and sat around until I got bored. And we came home, and I was real proud of myself. And Max went to bed and went to sleep, and I went to the bar and got drunk. And it worked real well. And it worked so well, I was so proud of myself that from then on we bought scotch by the case. And when I decided to clean out the bar, I had to drink all this. I had to drink the scotch and then the brandies and the straight bourbon. And then I got to the blended. Those seemed to upset me. And finally, I got down to rum, which I had crossed off my list. I didn't drink that anymore. And then I got to the last thing was the rye whiskey. I'd given that up a long time ago. It just didn't seem to mix with my system, you know. And finally, then I had to drink up the liqueurs and the cream de coco and cream de noia and the Gallianos and especially cream de mint. I thought that was kind of classy to sit there after dinner and drink cream de mint. You know, what's wrong with that? It's just an after-dinner liqueur, and you clink the glass, or the ice cubes in the glass. Have to do it kind of fast, because two ice cubes don't last very long in a 12-ounce glass of cream de mint. weeks at a time where my bowel evacuations were totally green. I was very sincere, and I was willing to go to any length to lick this bowel. Well, I did a lot of other things. Made a lot of novenas and prayers and things like that, as they say. And used to go to... And I threw all that out, and I never did that anymore. It was very complicated doing it, too, I'll tell you that, especially when you're not very sober. I obviously couldn't drive down to the office and squirt it in my vein and go to sleep and still drive back to the house to go to bed. And I couldn't lie in bed and squirt it in there and have Paula saying, "Hey, Ann, come and watch Daddy take his nightly fix." And the kids got in the way. And Max was kind of nosy about things like that anyway. And so, Maxine, and so what I did is I kept it in my bag, and I kept my bag in the car, in the garage, and the garage luckily was attached to the house. And what I do is I have to go out there and find some reason to go to the garage, and I go out there, and I have to calculate the amount in the syringe that I could squirt in, take it out, take a drink, about throw it in the back, close the bag, throw the bag in the car, shut the door, run in the house and jump in bed to fall asleep. And, you know, I was getting to where I needed a computer to do it. But that wasn't any more complicated than life itself was at that time. Everything seemed just about that complicated. Everything was getting worse and worse, and I was even more and more anxious to be dead. I was giving an awful lot of thought to suicide. Only one thing worse than being alive would be to have to live on being an attempted suicide, and I didn't want that. And but I think the main thing was that when I wanted to kill me, I wanted to kill the me that was doing all these things that I'm talking about. And but I didn't know how to do that without killing another me that nobody'd ever seen yet, the one that had all these high expectations and that hidden potential that had never broken through. I felt there was something there if I could just somehow get it out. But the guy that was getting drunk was all the time screwing it up for the other guy, and I couldn't kill one without the other. I think that was the feeling that I tended to have. I ended up one night with acute pancreatitis, and the temperature 104, a tremendous bellyache, and a trip to the hospital, and all the doctors for miles around knew that Dr. Oliver was in the hospital with pancreatitis, and they all know that you either have pancreatitis from gallstones or from being a chronic drunk. And God, I wished I had a gallstone. I'd have given anything for a gallstone down there. All I had was just plain old pancreatitis. You don't hear about it very much around here, actually. I think if any of you are planning a slip, you really ought to plan an attack of pancreatitis on your itinerary. It really adds a lot to your experiences, I think. Every alcoholic ought to have at least once. If you haven't had it by now, don't try. And then I went to bed without taking anything to help me sleep. And on both occasions, in the morning, I had a grand mal convulsion. And so my immediate reaction was, I hadn't drunk anything the night before, therefore alcohol had nothing to do with my convulsion. So I didn't bother to tell the doctor that was treating me for the convulsion that I drank, because it wasn't pertinent to the problem. And it obviously had nothing to do with it. And besides, I don't think he asked me. If he did, I lied. I don't know. But we got by that somehow. With the second convulsion, though, he decided he didn't know what trouble was. And so he thought maybe I ought to go, or he'd gotten his training, he'd send me back to the Mayo Clinic. And I thought, you know, that's good. Because being a diagnostician and being really very smart, I put together all my diagnostic acumen, me knowing my case better than anybody else, I came up with a diagnosis that I had a brain tumor. I was glad, because I figured it'd be inoperable, and I'd die, and you'd all be sorry. So I had to take my brain tumor back to the Mayo Clinic, and we'd find out that that's what I had, and that would be the end of the story. And so Max packed the bags, and I packed the booze, and we went back to the Mayo Clinic. And back there they have this big building, and several of them, and these rinky-dink hotels around it, and you run around through tunnels to get back and forth to these buildings. I'd probably still be running around through those tunnels if Max hadn't come along. It took 9 days of tests and running through those tunnels and drinking and pill taking to get the test done. And we got all through, and I went to see this big brain surgeon who was going to tell me that it was inoperable and it was too bad. And especially bad since it was right before Christmas of 66. And he says, I think you ought to see our staff psychiatrist. And I thought, well, you know, that's kind of dumb. Don't know what he wants me to see him for, but I figured I want to be thorough. So I go to see the guy, and this jerk says, I think you ought to go into our locked ward for a period of observation. And I didn't know how to get out of it, so I decided I'd give it a whirl to prove I didn't need it. And I knew I didn't need it when they locked that damn steel door shut on me. When that slammed shut and Max went home, I knew I was starting to get into trouble. It was a dumb place to be, especially for Christmas. They'd turn off the lights and the lights wouldn't go out. They wanted to watch you, so you didn't. They didn't trust you at all. It was so dumb. I remember one time they wanted to drag me out of there to ice and Christmas cookies. Some female nut in a white uniform dragged me out of there. And they were staggering down to this room and sit me down. And she held my hand as I tried to stab the icing and smear it on these Christmas cookies and without smashing them in my hand, you know. And I don't know how many mashed cookies I had before I told her what she could do with her cookies. You know? I felt I just had to get out of that place. It wasn't the place for me. And so I knew enough how to get out, and I knew how to yell at Max enough to make her feel guilty, enough that she would accept responsibility for me so I could sign out. And I promised never to do anything ever bad again, and scout's honor and all that stuff. And had a terrible time signing my name on that chart to sign my release to get out, and made all these silly promises. Silly, but very sincere, I'm sure, at the time. Until we got on the plane and we had a big fight over whether or not I was going to drink the free booze, you know. And she won. She always wins. She won, and I didn't drink the booze, and but I showed her I didn't eat, and I pouted the whole way home. You know? We got back home, and I got a bottle of scotch and drank it and went to bed. And in the morning, she called this neurologist that had sent me out there, told him about the psychiatrist, and he says, well, we better check on that. Let's have him see the psychiatrist here. And I thought, well, that's okay. I'll let him straighten this out. And I went to see him. We spent about 45 minutes talking to him and 10 minutes talking to Max and about 3 minutes talking to me. And he says, well, I think you ought to go into our locked ward. I thought, well, you know, he can't disagree with the Mayo Clinic until he does the things that they did and then proves that they're wrong. And so I'll go in, just to go along with it to get this record straightened out. And so I went to the lock board there. And it seemed to me he said I'd only have to stay about 5 days. And besides, he didn't pay any attention to me. He gave me a lot of pills and I was groggy and I was jerking and flying apart. Every time my arm would fly off sometimes, I'd look to see if anybody noticed, you know. And I'd be in bed and half asleep, and the nurse would come to give me something and touch me. I'd fly out of bed, and she'd throw the pills all over the place. And, I was pretty jerky, literally, in those days. But anyway, he would come in and he'd go and see the other patients, and he wouldn't pay attention to me, seemed like. And I was getting better all the time, and I would catch him by the door as he's going out. You know, I'd stop him, and I'd say, you know, I'm doing so good, I don't think I need to stay for the whole 5 days, and I need to get out here. And he says, I didn't say 5 days, I said a week. And I thought, oh. So I waited a few more days, you know, and I caught him again, and I said, man, I really feel good, and I got all these patients waiting for me, and a lot of work to do, and people need me, and I just can't stay a whole week, I need to get out of here. And he says, I didn't say a week, I said 2 weeks. And it seemed to me like we did that about 3 times, and every time I said anything, this nut upped the ante on me. And I thought, you know, I may never get out of here at this rate. And I ain't never going to ask that jerk again to discharge me. But I'm going to figure out some way to get enough brownie points to get out of here. And, you know, and it's boring in a place like that. I just refuse to make those leather belts. Just didn't seem like the sort of thing that a man in my position ought to be doing, you know? And besides, I couldn't understand the instructions, you know? And I was damned if I was going to ask her again to explain it. So I just sat there. So that actually was kind of a pretty fair game when he came up to me one day and he says, how would I like to talk to the man from AA? And I didn't know why. And I certainly didn't know what I could do for the man. But, you know, but I thought, man, if you think it's a good idea, I think it's a good idea. And I thought, you know, maybe he wants me to learn something I can use on my patients when I get out of here or something. And so I says, okay. And in about 30 seconds, it seems, here's this guy comes running in and yelling, my name is Frank and I'm an alcoholic. Ah, 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 you know. I feel sorry for him, really. Here's a man, he's got nothing in the world to brag about except that he's an alcoholic. That's all I can talk about. So I listened to his story. And it went on and on and on. I thought he'd never stop talking. And he finally did. And he says, well, that's my story. He says, I'm going to the meeting tonight. Would you like to go along? And I said, hell no, I won't like it, but I'll go. But I knew he'd go and talk to that psychiatrist if I didn't. And I don't remember what meetings he took me to. And I don't remember how many meetings I went to before I remembered the meeting I was at. Or something. But I remember one day he said something about, tonight I think they'll take you down to Laguna Beach because they've got, and I don't even remember what they said they got, but they must have had it because I kept going back there afterward. And, you know, I can't describe my first meeting. I hear some beautiful pitches on that. Where somebody will get up and they'll tell you who was leading and who read the prayer and who was speaking and what they said and all these profound things. I didn't hear anything profound. I heard a lot of nonsense. Some idiot said, for me to drink is to die. And I thought, oh, God, they'll go to any lengths to frighten you into joining this organization. Big deal. And another guy said, if I don't take a drink today, I'm a success today. And I thought, God almighty, for you Skid Row bums, that might be all right. But I got a lot of things I got to do today before not taking a drink is important. And it seemed like the dumbest thing I ever heard. And yeah, as a matter of fact, just last week, I remember so vividly using that. I had a real hectic day, a whole lot of things happening, people crowding me in, and a lot of things going on at once, and people having heart attacks without appointments. And at one point,
I thought, if I would just stop and meditate for just a few seconds, everything would get better. And my response was, yeah, I'll do that as soon as I finish this and this and this, you know. And I never got back to meditating. But the day was all right. It was a good day, because I kept having the thought, if I don't take a drink today, I'll be a success today. And gee, that's important to me today. That's helped me tremendously to know that to narrow, that's the one thing that really happened to me in AA. I came here with just hundreds of problems, just hundreds of them. And just drinking was in there somewhere, but gee, you know, all these big things. And I came here and you didn't want to pay attention to that. When you reached in and picked out one problem, and you said, just handle that one problem just for one day at a time, and things will get better. And it worked. And that's the way it works today. When I get all screwed up with things, if I can narrow life down to just one problem for one day, all the other things are secondary, and somehow I get through the day, and it's a real comfortable day. I don't think I was a nut when he said it, but I say it all the time now. Other people, somebody said AA means altered attitudes. Somebody said, nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent. And I thought, in fact, I think it was an Al-Anon that said it. I hate to admit it, but, you know, and I thought, if nobody can make me feel inferior, then nobody can make me angry, or depressed, or anxious, or afraid. That nobody has control over my emotions, that I have a choice of my emotions. And I've been trying to practice that. I found that when I became willing to go to any lengths to maintain my physical sobriety, maintaining my physical sobriety has been no problem. That was 7 months after I'd been on it. It took me 7 months to get sober on this program, which I don't think is so bad considering the fact that I wasn't even an alcoholic when I came here. And when I was willing to go to any length, to do anything at any time, anywhere, to stay physically sober, then I don't have to do most of those things and I have no problem with staying physically sober. And I become conscious now of staying emotionally and spiritually sober. And I think the two are very close. I don't know if I could separate them. And I have to be willing to go to any length to stay emotionally and spiritually sober. And I find I used to not, I keep a high value on my emotional sobriety. I used to have a very low value on it. I would give it away to just about anybody. Throw it at somebody passing on the freeway, or whatever, you know. But now I think before, I'm going to say I think before I explode, I don't. Once I've exploded, then I get to thinking, and I know what I need to do to get back to it. Max still screws me all up, you know. But then I realized she didn't, really. I did. And when I can accept my alcoholism totally, then I have no problem with alcohol. And when I can accept Max totally, I have no marital problems. And when I can accept life totally, as it is today. Somebody from the podium one time said, whatever is right. She didn't say everything's going to be all right. She said, whatever is right. And when I can accept today's situation exactly as it is, then I don't have any living problem. And I can do that as long as I live by these steps and turn it all over to God. I often feel that I don't have a very spiritual program because I don't pray a lot. I no longer recite prayers and the Venus and rosaries. I don't have long conversations with God. Commonly getting in the car, gratitude, I'm very conscious of gratitude and thoughts of God, of gratitude to God. Thanks, God. Thanks a hell of a lot. I remember the other day jumping in the car, slapping the fender of the car, and thinking, well, God, what kind of a day are we going to have today? And he said, Paul, if you don't have a good day today, it's your own fault. I went out to the garage this morning to get the suitcases to pack them down here, and I thought, geez, we're going down there, maybe I better ask him for help when I'm going to get down here on the podium. And I said, no, that's not part of our work contract. The deal is that I do the work, I do what looks like I'm supposed to do, and he takes care of the results.
So I'm having a good time here. If you're getting nothing out of this, that's your fault. I don't know. I'm also taking a lot of time. You have to blame it all on my higher power. But anyway, I was saying that on a formal prayer, the Lord's Prayer, it's great, and I say it at the end of the meeting along with you. Frankly, a lot of times my mind wanders, and I mix the phrases up, and I immediately look around to see who heard me. And even the Serenity Prayer, I can screw that up. I can get hold of that courage to change the things I can't. And man, once I start trying to change something, acceptance goes right out the window. It's either acceptance or try to change it, but I can't work them both. I gotta stick to this. I can just narrow the Serenity Prayer down to acceptance and forget that change bit, because that can really screw me up and screw up my thinking. Anyway, I've rattled on here enough. As I said, I'm real glad to be here. I'm glad to be who I am and what I am, doing what I'm doing, and heading where I'm heading. I like that. I like being an alcoholic. I think being an alcoholic is such a good idea that I'm surprised I didn't think of it myself. That's my story. You may not have drunk like I did, and you may have drunk more, you may have hurt more. I don't know. I don't care. I don't feel any competition in AA. And that's my story, and I may not tell it well, and you may not be very impressed, but just impresses the devil out of me. Thank you.